This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Man Alive by G.K. Chesterton. Section 11. Part 1. The Enigmas of Innocent Smith. Chapter 5. The Allegorical Practical Joker. Part 3. Smith may be mad, went on the melancholy moon in a monologue that seemed as heavy as a hatchet, but there was something after all in what he said about home rule for every home. Yes, there is something, when all said and done, in the High Court of Beacon. It is really true that human beings might often get some sort of domestic justice where just now they can only get legal injustice. Oh, I'm a lawyer, too, and I know that as well. It is true that there isn't too much official and indirect power. Often and often the thing a whole nation can't settle is just the thing a family could settle. Scores of young criminals have been fined and sent to jail when they ought to have been thrashed and sent to bed. Scores of men, I am sure, have had a lifetime at Hanwell when they only wanted a week at Brighton. There is something in Smith's notion of domestic self-government, and I propose that we put it into practice. You have the prisoner, you have the documents. Come, we are a company of free, white, Christian people, such as might be besieged in a town or cast up on a desert island. Let us do this thing ourselves. Let us go into that house there and sit down and find out with our own eyes and ears whether this thing is true or not. Whether this Smith is a man or a monster. If we can't do a little thing like that, what right have we to put crosses on ballots? Inglewood and Pym exchanged a glance, and Warner, who was no fool, saw in that glance that Moon was gaining ground. The motives that led Arthur to think of surrender were indeed very different from those which affected Dr. Cyrus Pym. All Arthur's instincts were on the side of privacy and polite settlement. He was very English, and would often endure wrongs rather than right them by scenes and serious rhetoric. To play at once the buffoon and the knight-errant, like his Irish friend, would have been absolute torture to him. But even the semi-official part he had played that afternoon was very painful. He was not likely to be reluctant if anyone could convince him that his duty was to let sleeping dogs lie. On the other hand, Cyrus Pym belonged to a country in which things are possible that seem crazy to the English. Regulations and authorities, exactly like one of Innocent's pranks or one of Michael's satires, really exist, propped by placid policemen and imposed on bustling businessmen. Pym knew whole states which are vast and yet secret and fanciful. Each is as big as a nation, yet as private as a lost village, and as unexpected as apple pie bed. States where no man may have a cigarette, states where any man may have 10 wives, very strict prohibition states, very lax divorce states. All these large local vagaries had prepared Cyrus Pym's mind for small local vagaries in a smaller country, infinitely more remote from England than any Russian or Italian. Utterly incapable of even conceiving what English conventions are, he could not see the social impossibility of the Court of Beacon. It is firmly believed by those who shared the experiment that to the very end Pym believed in that phantasmal court, and supposed it to be some Britannic institution. Towards the synod, thus somewhat at a standstill, there approached through the growing haze and gloaming a short, dark figure with a walk apparently founded on the imperfect repression of a negro breakdown. Something at once in the familiarity and the incongruity of this being moved Michael to even heartier outbursts of a healthy and humane flippancy. "While here's little Nosey Gould," he exclaimed, "isn't the mere sight of him enough to banish all your morbid reflections?" "Really," replied Dr. Warner, "I really fail to see how Mr. Gould affects the question, and I once more demand—" "Hello, "What's the funeral, gents?" inquired the newcomer with the air of an uproarious umpire. "Doctor demanding something? Always the way at a boarding house, you know. Always lots of demand, no supply." As delicately and impartially as he could, Michael restated his position and indicated generally that Smith had been guilty of certain dangerous and dubious acts, and that there had even arisen an allegation that he was insane. "Well, of course he is," said Moses Gould equably. "It don't need old Ohms to see that. The 'awk-like face of Ohms," he added with abstract relish, "showed a shade of disappointment, the sleuth-like Gould having got there before him." "If he is mad," began Inglewood. "Well," said Moses, "when a cove gets out on the tile the first night, there's generally a tile loose." "You never objected before," said Diana Duke rather stiffly, "and you're generally pretty free with your complaints." "I don't complain of him," said Moses magnanimously. "The poor chap's armless enough. You might tie him up in the garden here, and he'd make noises at the burglars." "Moses," said Moon with solemn fervour, "you are the incarnation of common sense. You think Mr. Innocent is mad. Let me introduce you to the incarnation of scientific theory. He also thinks Mr. Innocent Smith is mad. Doctor, this is my friend Mr. Gould. Moses, this is the celebrated Dr. Pym." The celebrated Dr. Cyrus Pym closed his eyes and bowed. He also murmured his national war cry in a low voice which sounded like, "Pleased to meet you." "Now, you two people," said Michael cheerfully, "who both think our poor friend mad, shall jolly well go into that house over there and prove him mad. What could be more powerful than the combination of scientific theory with common sense? United you stand, divided you fall. I will not be so uncivil as to suggest that Dr. Pym has no common sense. I confine myself to recording the chronological accident that he has not shown us any so far. I take the freedom of an old friend in staking my shirt that Moses has no scientific theory. Yet against this strong coalition I am ready to appear armed with nothing but an intuition, which is American for a guess." "Distinguished by Mr. Gould's assistance," said Pym, opening his eyes suddenly, "I gather that though he and I are identical in primary diagnosis, there is yet between us something that cannot be called a disagreement, something which we may perhaps call up—" He put the points of a thumb and forefinger together, spreading the other fingers exquisitely in the air, and seemed to be waiting for somebody else to tell him what to say. "Catchin' flies?" inquired the affable Moses. "A divergence," said Dr. Pym, with a refined sigh of relief. "A divergence. Granted that the man in question is deranged, he would not necessarily be all that science requires in a homicidal maniac." "Has it occurred to you," observed Moon, who was leaning on the gate again and did not turn round, "that if he were a homicidal maniac, he might have killed us all here while we were talking?" Something exploded silently underneath all their minds, like sealed dynamite in some forgotten cellars. They all remembered for the first time, for some hour or two, that the monster of whom they were talking was standing quietly among them. They had left him in the garden, like a garden statue. There might have been a dolphin coiling round his legs, or a fountain pouring out of his mouth, for all the notice they had taken of Innocent Smith. He stood with his crest of blonde, blown hair thrust somewhat forward, his fresh-coloured, rather short-sighted face looking patiently downwards at nothing in particular, his huge shoulders humped and his hands in his trousers pockets. So far as they could guess, he had not moved at all. His green coat might have been cut out of the green turf on which he stood. In his shadow, Pym had expounded and Rosamund expostulated. Michael had ranted and Moses had ragged. He had remained, like a thing graven, the god of the garden. A sparrow had perched on one of his heavy shoulders and then, after correcting its costume of feathers, had flown away. "Why," cried Michael with a shout of laughter, "the court of Beacon has opened. And shut up again, too. You all know now I am right. Your buried common sense has told you what my buried common sense has told me. Smith might have fired off 100 cannons instead of a pistol, and you would still know he was harmless as I know he is harmless. Back we all go to the House and clear a room for discussion, for the High Court of Beacon, which has already arrived at its decision, is just about to begin its inquiry. "Just going to begin," cried little Mr. Moses, in an extraordinary sort of disinterested excitement, like that of an animal during a music or a thunderstorm. "Follow on to the High Court of Eggs and Bacon. Have a kipper from the old firm. Its lordship complimented Mr. Gould on the eye of professional delicacy he had shown, and which was worthy of the best traditions of the saloon bar, and three of Scotch hot, miss. Oh, chase me, girls." The girls betrayed no temptation to chase him. He went away in a sort of waddling dance of pure excitement, and had made a circuit of the garden before he reappeared breathless, but still beaming. Moon had known his man when he realized that no people presented to Moses Gould could be quite serious, even if they were quite furious. The glass door stood open on the side nearest to Mr. Moses Gould, and as the feet of that festive idiot were evidently turned in the same direction, everybody else went that way with the unanimity of some uproarious procession. Only Diana Duke retained enough rigidity to say the thing that had been boiling at her fierce feminine lips for the last few hours. Under the shadow of tragedy, she had kept it back as unsympathetic. "In that case," she said sharply, "these cabs can be sent away." "Well, Innocent must have his bag, you know," said Mary with a smile. "I dare say the cabman would get it down for us." "I'll get the bag," said Smith, speaking for the first time in hours. His voice sounded remote and rude, like the voice of a statue. Those who had so long danced and disputed round his immobility were left breathless by his precipitance. With a run and spring he was out of the garden into the street. With a spring and one quivering kick he was actually on the roof of the cab. The cabman happened to be standing by the horse's head, having just removed its emptied nose-bag. Smith seemed for an instant to be rolling about on the cab's back in the embraces of his Gladstone bag. The next instant, however, he had rolled, as if by a royal luck, into the high seat behind, and with a shriek of piercing and appalling suddenness had sent the horse flying and scampering down the street. His evanescence was so violent and swift that this time it was all the other people who were turned into garden statues. Mr. Moses Gould, however, being ill-adapted both physically and morally for the purposes of permanent sculpture, came to life some time before the rest, and turning to Moon remarked, like a man standing chattily with a stranger on an omnibus, "Tile loose, huh? Cab loose, anyhow." There followed a fatal silence, and then Dr. Warner said with a sneer like a club of stone, "This is what comes of the Court of Beacon, Mr. Moon. You have let loose a maniac on the whole metropolis." Beacon House stood, as it has been said, at the end of a long crescent of continuous houses. The little garden that shut it in ran out into a sharp point like a green cape pushed into the sea of two streets. Smith and his cab shot up one side of the triangle, and certainly most of those standing inside of it never expected to see him again. At the apex, however, he turned the horse sharply round and drove with equal violence up the other side of the garden. Visible to all those in the group, with a common impulse, the little crowd ran across the lawn as if to stop him. But they soon had reason to duck and recoil. Even as he vanished up the street for the second time, he let the big yellow bag fly from his hand, so that it fell in the center of the garden, scattering the company like a bomb, and nearly damaging Dr. Warner's hat for the third time. Long before they had collected themselves, the cab had shot away with a shriek that went into a whisper. "Well," said Michael Moon, with a queer note in his voice, "you may as well all go inside anyhow. We've got two relics of Mr. Smith, at least, his fiancée and his trunk." "Why do you want us to go inside?" asked Arthur Inglewood, in whose red brow and rough brown hair botheration seemed to have reached its limit. End of section 11.